So, Red, I'm curious. Have you felt it? The change in the mana lately? Something big happened. If I'm not mistaken, it almost feels like there's more magic or different kind. Tarot. It's not traditionally my thing, but I'll look into it. And the Sealy? Well, that explains some of my buddies in Ireland not checking in. Really? In Yellowstone? And it's stable? What does that mean? Huh. Anyway, thanks for taking point in that job last week. I needed that intel to save some chummers of mine. You straight from the most reliably biased source of the Matrix. Broadcasting as a proud member of the Shadowcasters Network, I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo Anarchist Podcast. This is our first episode of Season 4, and as always, I'm going to start this season by giving some Neo Anarchist truth ranting, just to remind us all why we do this. Anarchism is not just another model of government, neither is it simply a lack of any sort of governance. Recognizing the many ways that anarchism has been misrepresented, I'd put forth that at its heart, anarchy is a posture of seeing domination, authority, and hierarchy through a lens of suspicion and skepticism. When it sees a dominating or hierarchical structure in society, ranging from patriarchy to imperialism, it questions whether or not those structures are justified. And this is important. Anarchism takes as a base assumption that the burden of proof for this question lies with those in positions of power and authority. Authority is not self-justifying. Unless there is a justification for it, which there almost never is, the authority, power, and control should be deconstructed and replaced by something that gives more freedom and more justice. And while it takes different forms depending on the context, this is the tendency of anarchy. Anarchism, although I myself sometimes romanticize the aesthetic, is not the picture of punks running wild, breaking windows, destroying property, but rather the dreams of a very orderly society. However it is organized, not by hierarchy or authority, but from the bottom up, using direct participation on every level, eliminating ever more control or domination as possible, ideally ending up with none. In our world, some that call themselves anarchists or seekers of liberty instead just represent another kind of tyranny, which is unaccountable private tyranny. True anarchism is not that. We call for an elimination of tyranny, all kinds of tyranny. That includes tyranny that is held by private citizens or especially corporations. Guns, magic, and the Matrix are used by corporations and Shadowrunners alike to enforce their will onto others, which is why you must be cautious of your ego and your selfishness. If it doesn't benefit everyone, it benefits no one. Freedom is better than subordination. Freedom is better than slavery. It's better to be able to make your own decisions than to have someone else make decisions and force you to like it. You don't need me to tell you that. Like all truth, it just rings. So let it stay with you this season as we turn back to our regularly scheduled programming. And now here's a few more questions from our listeners for our Dear Opti segment. Dear Opti, does a mage infected with CFD lose his mojo? Can whatever the thing that he's becoming even use magic? Oh, and my significant other wants to know a neo-anarchist's opinion on the adversary. From Catherine Bunt. Catherine, those are good questions. First, regarding the mage with CFD, I would say no. No mojo loss at all. Of course, in order to contract CFD, one has to have a symbiotic relationship with nanites, which are foreign. So that right there could, or maybe would, limit the mage's connection to the manosphere, even if just a little. But after that initial loss, I can see no reason why CFD would cause any further loss of mojo. However, that isn't to say that the alternate personality or personalities would have access to those abilities in the same way that the original personality of the mage would. To your second question, I can only speak of this anarchist's opinion on the adversary. I know some very good chummers of mine who hold the adversary as their totem, and that hasn't stopped them from being good people. And yet, the adversary exists positively only in a very small context. Yes, the adversary can be helpful if you're standing against something oppressive or corrupt, but that same totem often calls for rebellion against noble and good things as well. There isn't anything righteous or awesome about fighting or judging or resisting something for its own sake. If there is no greater good being pursued, perhaps rebellion is not worth the lives lost. And in all my interactions with the adversary and its followers, even my chummers, I have found tremendous power for destroying and accusing, but no equally great power to build up or advocate for anything good. So I guess there is a place for the adversary to be okay, but as I've experienced it, it's like cutting off the nose to spite the face in the long term. A deal with the devil, if you'll forgive the obvious pun. ForkBoy088 asks, Dear Opti, what are your criteria for deciding to hide in a bolt hole and vanish? Well, ForkBoy, there are a few things. Like once in a while when my studio / safe house is destroyed, as is the case now and has been a few times in the recent past. Another is when a wave of bugs crawl through my hood in the blast zone. Sometimes when DeForest or Gowan get into trouble, or when a giant AAA megacorp is on my back. Other than that, I'm easy to find. Why do you ask? William Sullivan asks, Dear Opti, what is your favorite pie? Well, I like almost all pie, but my favorite is cheesecake, which is a pie, regardless of having cake in the name. Dear Opti, what type of Shadowrun do you hate doing the most, besides wet work? From Johnny Miller. Well, Miller, I really appreciate the importance of doing extractions and protection runs, but I have found that the stress caused by those, not only having to worry about the threats and plans of a job, but also the safety of another person who may or may not have any common sense or ability to keep themselves alive, means that I take an extra week off afterwards just to decompress. Those are not my favorite. I'll do them all day, but I won't like them. Hey, keep those questions coming in. You can get them to me on the Face Matrix or shoot me a message at opti@neo-anarchist.com, and I will make your lives enhanced by answering them. And now, brace yourself for Season 4 as we daringly dive into the deep end of the pool of history discussing the dearth of deeds from 2070. And first up is our geopolitical overview. This was a big year for Seattle in that they were in the midst of a gubernatorial election. For most of the year, three main candidates plastered their faces everywhere. Julius Struthers, Josephine Djougashvili, and Kenneth Brackhaven. To say that the election was nasty is an understatement. Keeping local, Seattle was shaken by a serial killer labeled the Mayan Cutter. The Cutter had a trademark of sedating his victims with a neurotoxin, then using an obsidian knife to form ritualistic patterns into various parts of their bodies. The Cutter primarily victimized the orc population, and then just stopped. It wasn't caught until 2072, when it was revealed that he was Jose Martin, a disgruntled former Aztechnology factory worker. France and the allied German states announced a new sport called Rad Wars, a sort of urban brawl set in toxic zones. Durruti Leon, an infamous terrorist, unleashes a wave of attacks and assassinations against Munich particularly. It's wealthy, it's corrupt, and it's political, and it's corporate, and it's popular citizens. As it turns out, he was being manipulated by Neonet, and when he found out, he unleashed a poison gas attack during the Oktoberfest, and he killed himself. On November 2nd, Seattle elects Kenneth Brackhaven as their new governor. Dana Oakes becomes the youngest ADA, the assistant district attorney, in Seattle history, and because of her fearless attitude and dedication, became the de facto right hand of David Beatty. In another election, 2070 Republicans take control of the UCAS House of Representatives after 34 years without a majority in either house. December 25th finds the radioactive Sox area of Germany, where a group of Shadowrunners aided by French military forces make an attack against corporate facilities. In a rather convoluted story, which involves some future-telling omens and rich people trying to take power, but not much changes in the Sox. And finally, tuberculosis makes a comeback in 2070. Of course, the strain is resistant to antibiotics, and if you get it, you are just fair and truly fragged. Thankfully, it is uncommon to catch, but still, be careful. Now, I want to take a special segment of our Neo-Anarchist podcast to talk about technomancers, because this next bit is all over the map, from corporations to politics to tech, so I'm giving it its own section. Because in many ways, it's the defining event of 2070, and that is the technomancer phenomenon. So, in 2069, Misuhama sponsored a certain Project ROM, and a Dr. Schalbermatt began performing unethical experimentation on captured so-called Virtua Kinetics, those who could manipulate and inhabit the Matrix using only their minds. Over the course of 2069, Neonet agents continue to try and poach Schalbermatt from Misuhama. He wasn't against it, but he was dragging his feet. Which brings us to 2070, the year in which the world finds another group to fear and hate. In May of 2070, Neonet decided that they didn't want to wait any longer for Shalbermat to decide. Neonet knew that Project ROM was operating secretly from the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Hong Kong, so they drew up plans to extract Shalbermat, whether he wanted it or not. In late June 2070, they pulled the trigger. Neonet hired 9x9, a Hong Kong-based anti-corporate group, to create a diversion in order to get the Hong Kong Executive Council off their back. Unfortunately, the Executive Council found out about the planned attack and raided 9x9's hideout, throwing off Neonet's plan. As it turns out, Shadowrunners were already en route to extract Shalbermat when he was called back to Queen Elizabeth Hospital due to one of their Virtua Kinetic projects resisting and escaping the lab. In the aftermath, a hacking attempt causes the hospital computers to crash, allowing the rogue patient to run amok and free other Virtua Kinetics who proceed to wreak havoc on the surrounding systems as they escape. Fearing what the test subjects might reveal, Misuhama panics and tries to get out ahead of the news by setting off bombs at Queen Elizabeth Hospital, killing Shalbermat along with 342 patients, 58 medical staff, and burying any evidence of their deeds, then blaming the explosion on what they call violent and unpredictable technomancers. Of course, the public eats up prejudice like ice cream, and so these Virtua Kinetics, now commonly called technomancers, become public enemy number one. Corporations and national governments uniformly freak out at the implications of beings who can manipulate their most sensitive information and systems at will. The responses all differ, but roundups, arrests, executions far outweighed the wait-and-see approach. On July 5th, the United Nations met in Switzerland to discuss what they called the technomancer threat. As July went on, corporations continued scapegoating technomancers and megacorps fed the hysteria and public paranoia. Technomancers were blamed for the crash of 64, blamed for illegal matrix access, brain hacking, financial manipulation, and pretty much every other social ill imaginable. This media-led mob soon descended into ubiquitous persecution and violence against technos, forcing most underground and into the shadows. And of course, many non-technos were accused of being one and were arrested, beaten, and worse. Behind the scenes, however, corps began to try and identify technomancers and begin secret programs designed to capture and study them in order to control their abilities for their own profit. Horizon Group stood apart from the other corps by publicly aiding technomancers and giving them safe haven. As a result, technos and AIs found Horizon to be an oasis amid the global turmoil. This intense hatred continued unabated until September 18th, when Denver reporter Jane McCrory released a recording that showed horrifying pictures of graphic corporate experimentation on technomancers, including children. Further, these children were kidnapped from their families. To their credit, the public finally woke up and realized that the hate and fear could not justify torture and persecution of innocent children. A few months later, in December, nations began to respond more thoughtfully to technomancers, in ways both more and less positive. The UCAS passed the Technomancer Registration Act, protecting some technomancer rights, but also requiring them to register their abilities, similar to the Awaken. Japan passed similar laws, requiring mandatory testing of children for technomancer abilities, but Empress Hitomi Shiawase set up a government-funded school for young technomancers. In Egypt, the Coptic Christian Pope officially offers technomancers sanctuary who also identify as people of the book. And as a result, Alexandria and Cairo become sanctuaries for technomancers and other hackers taking in refugees from across Asia and Europe. The German Catholic Church responded by founding the Laodicea Order, a religious order of technomancers. In tangentially related news, Lone Star's inability to provide adequate security to what was only a perceived problem, along with the previous year's tempo crisis, forced the removal of Lone Star CEO Theodore W.D. Winslow and his replacement with Gerald Hampton. Hampton immediately began to restructure Lone Star, aiming for a more rapid and robust customer service orientation. And in a bit of non-hate-filled news, Proteus AG discovered a pod of technomancer dolphins in Okinawa while they attempted to rescue a trapped member from an underwater flu. And from the Virtua Kinetically Strange now to the corporate events of 2070. On November 10th in Los Angeles, Horizon Group released Persona 2.0, a multimedia personal documenting communication and social rating system. And in the UCAS, John F. Kennedy Airport is remodeled and renamed the Hitomi International Airport after Empress Hitomi. Moving now into the non-technomancer-related tech news, starting before the crash of 2064, the beginnings of the wireless matrix were already being discussed. 2070 saw the wireless fall into place while the model of the Matrix has moved from a wire-bound virtual reality to a completely integrated and ubiquitous augmented reality. VR is still around, but AR reigns supreme in day-to-day use. Even the poorest sprawl rat has some sort of Matrix connectivity today, and that started in 2070. By 2070, BTL sales have mostly moved online, making the laws against them even more difficult to enforce. 2070 saw the world became overly mapped, photographed, indexed, imaged, and globally positioned. Cars now drive themselves, and data is everywhere. And by 2070, doctors had begun to mainstream the procedures, allowing them to do almost any form of aesthetic surgery, molding the metahuman form in almost every way imaginable. The end result is, if you have money, you probably look flawless, putting even more distance between the haves and the have-nots. And for something a bit more exciting, on August 18th, a rogue artificial intelligence named Sojourner took control of Aztechnology's Tlaloc orbital space station. Sojourner threatened to use biological weapons being researched on the station on Earth cities. Sojourner demanded that all experimentation on AIs cease and for all captive AIs to be set free. A second AI, allied with Horizon, calling itself Pulsar, stepped in to negotiate peace between Sojourner and the station. And finally, in December, an AI calling itself Bai Li officially announces its conversion to Buddhism. The magical events of 2070 are as follows. 2070 saw Australian mana storms increasing in magnitude, one of the effects of which is to drive termite spirits from the outback region and into coastal cities. In the spring, HMHVV2 was found to affect orcs in a unique way, creating creatures known as Grendels, first discovered in Pittsburgh. They look fierce, but are normally peaceful unless provoked. On August 20th, several magic artifacts, including the Phaistos disc, were stolen from a museum in Heraklion. Now, while it may not seem like a big deal, it has significance headed into the 2070s, as we'll see in the next few episodes. In Underworld news, the Donna of the Finnegan family, Rowena O'Malley, became the first Kappa of the Seattle Mafia by killing Maurice the Butcher Biggio. And in the section that is just as important as the others, at least in your hearts, is the culture of 2070. Taiko Ikimoto, his first concert, a simulcast sim feed called Konnichiwa Rainbow, went viral on a blog, and within 24 hours, he was picked up by Misuhama Music. Also in 2070, Wild Cards released their latest album, Stacking the Deck. The Tolson Twins released one of my personal favorite albums, Aztlan Tequila. Deirdre released Phoenix, and it should be noted that 2070, along with all of the other revolutions it produced, gave us a new interpretation of music. This new innovation was music springing directly from the musician's brain, but also customized to the listener with deepening understandings of how music affects us. Brain activity is monitored, and the music is adjusted in real time to become more appealing to the listener. This concept is soon called Yobumbu, or more frequently, Your Boom. And then there is Barry Manna. Barry is the performer who brought troll singers into the spotlight. He was working sanitation and sewage when he walked into the Big Rhino on one of its amateur nights. He sang classic jazz music in such a rich baritone voice that he wowed everyone there, for real. When a recording of it hit the Matrix, he became a legend. Finally, on April 11th, the great dragon Ronabwe signed a contract for Evo to produce a daily music review on the Matrix called Soothing the Savage Beast. I was also going to talk about some other stuff about some neo-anarchists in Montreal and Manhattan, but that'll keep for another time. Unfortunately, the time you spent listening here won't keep. You just wasted an entirely good slot of time listening to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of neo-anarchist street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crow funders is Steven, Sean Olivares, Olivares, John P. Francis, Complex Action, Jacob Hyde, and Laszlo Zingo. Thank you all. Everything you need to set up and maintain a neo-anarchist cell in your area, which at various levels now includes stickers every month, patches, dice bags, fake IDs of all sorts, contact sheets for Opti and his crew, USB cred sticks, sweet neo-anarchist t-shirts, whiskey glasses, temporary tattoos, and an upcoming album of Sixth World Musical Malarkey will be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. And I should note that we are a mere $28 away from Patreon level that unlocks the dog tag rewards for a specific Sixth World organization, which shall remain nameless until the unlock, since I don't want the corpse breathing down my neck. But stay tuned for the next episode for a hint. A really, really big hint. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unaninium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am your host, the never-scary Hail Mary Raspberry Apothecary Rebel Fairy, Aged Cherry, Always Wary, Awfully Hairy, Truth Library, Primary, Black Cherry, Dictionary, Dysentery, Sanctuary, Legendary, but still very ordinary, Opti. Enjoy your freedom. There's always someone who has less of it than you do.